outside.
What is that?
Radio.
Hey, welcome everybody to another show of Monster X Radio. Shane Corson here, and I've got a great show lined up tonight. I will be speaking with my guest and friend and researcher, Larry Turner, and we're going to get him on shortly. But of course, Monster X Radio is brought to you by Sasquatch Coffee. Have you tried it, Yeti? And you can find this coffee that I drink on a regular basis, as does my guest here on a regular basis drink this coffee, at SasquatchCoffee.com. It's the holiday season, so if you know somebody that loves coffee and maybe is interested in the Sasquatch phenomenon, what a perfect gift. I'll just say that right out there, perfect gift. Lots of flavors, whether it's coffee or you like a little bit of cocoa. They got it all, and my co-host Gunnar Monson's not here this evening with me, but with me along tonight is my guest Larry Turner. Like I said, he's a fellow researcher. He's a part of the Olympic Project that I work with. He's also part of the Tillamook Forest Group, and he's been researching the Sasquatch phenomena for quite a few years now. He's had his own personal experiences. He's been a past guest on the show, but he's one of the guys I love to have on the show because of his background, his knowledge, and his experiences, and just his approach to the Sasquatch phenomena when it comes to research. And so, Larry Turner, are you there?
I'm here, Shane.
Ah, there he is. Glad to have you on the show again, Larry. Like I said, I love to have you on the show. You really are a breath of fresh air when it comes to the research of this, and you're one of my favorite people to go out to the field with. We've done a lot of research together. We've had our own suspect encounters, and I know that we do a lot of audio recording. We do a lot of flaring, and we're always hypothesizing as to the next step to take. You know, we're always coming up with new ideas, and you, my friend, have plenty of ideas, so thanks for joining Monster X Radio again.
Oh, you're too kind. Thanks. Thanks for the intro there.
Well, it's true. It's true. You know, I know a lot of people in this field, as do you, and it's just nice to talk to somebody that's level-headed, that gets out in the field tremendously. The amount of times you're out in the woods, it mimics what I do, and I appreciate that because I know that you spend a ton of time, you know, out in the woods and using different methods, whether it's audio recording or just being out in nature in general. You're putting yourself out there, and that's something to be commended. And then also, one of the things I really appreciate about your research, Larry, is that you're very level-headed, pragmatic, and you're just full of ideas, and that's kind of why I wanted to invite you on the show this evening, because I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, research areas. You know, we have, you know, if you jump on social media or if you're just talking to somebody that's a fellow researcher, I always go, well, how did you pick out a certain area to research? I mean, what are the go-tos? Is there a go-to? How does somebody even go about looking for an area to research or just even possibly have an encounter? What are they looking for? And we were chatting earlier today about this very topic, And so I'm like, well, shoot, let's Larry, let's talk about this on the show. And so, yeah, Larry,
all right.
That's a little bit of
let's
lead through.
That.
But what do you look for, Larry, when you go out to an area? I mean, what are you looking for?
Well, there's two things. Well, first of all, let's put off the side where somebody actually has an experience, that they're actually landed in a spot that they weren't looking particularly and found an area. So we'll cross that one off. They got lucky. For those that want to try to pinpoint an area, Sasquatch, as you know, is like searching for a needle in a haystack. However, there are some criteria with regards to research areas that I look for. One is in, you know, especially in the Oregon Coast Range, it's proven out at least three times in different areas that altitude has a lot to do with that. And what I search for is the sweet spot where you have a high spot from a summit that drops down maybe 600 to 800 feet from that and then drops down another step. It's kind of a step. And I search for the middle part of that area. And the reason why is because that will be a microclimate. Microclimate is basically a climate in its own outside the normal climate area. Like, say, for instance, Portland will be 90 degrees in the summer. When we go to the our research area, it's 75, maybe 80 tops, and cools off even more. In the winter, there's a temperature inversion difference with regards that there'll be a whole bunch of snow driving all the way up there. And then once we get in the research area, there's significantly less snow and it's warmer.
Right, yeah.
And again, that's a temperature inversion, so it's just it's a microclimate, which is much easier on the animals. We found deer tracks running around there through the winter, elk, coyote. They seem to, you know, they hang out in these type of areas because it's not as rough on them. And the resources, the food resources are much easier to get at. The other thing what I look for, what we look for, is permanent water sources, i.e., permanent creeks or bodies of water. In the Pacific Northwest, you can't go more than 300 yards before you find a creek, so that's kind of a tough one. But during the hottest part of the year, you'll find those year-round creeks are always running. That's another thing that I look for. What I look for is year-round creeks. That's a water source. A permanent water source. And again, that's proven out in three different areas, including where your area is, a similar things to what I'm speaking about, but the one up at Mount Hood and where you had your encounter is identical with regards to those three requirements so far.
Yeah, and
another
of course,
requirement that, go ahead.
Of course we're talking, about Oregon here, specifically at the moment. We'll probably switch to Washington in a second, but yeah, we're talking about the Oregon Coastal Range and of course Mount Hood in Oregon, which actually just tonight just received quite a little bit of a rupture or quake. But those areas you're discussing now, I just want to make sure the audience is aware of the the area. Yeah, go ahead, Larry.
So basically right now we're just kind of talking about the Oregon Coast Range. And then I'll segue into some of my thoughts about Washington. And, of course, the Cascade Mountain Range, we're up in the Mount Hood area, and the similarities that we've discovered with regards to altitude, microclimates, and year-round water sources. Another thing what we look for is food sources, the ungulates, the deer, the elk, believe it or not, even squirrels. That's a protein pack. And then animals such as bear, they seem to hang around these areas too. And the reason why they hang around these areas is also year-round food sources that you could identify. Huckleberries, lemongrass, it looks sort of like a four-leaf clover. They taste like lemon. They're prolific in some of these areas here. Let's see what, we had a show a while back about all the mushrooms and stuff that come online.
Yeah.
But these are permanent food sources around. that is really important. And then one of the most important things that I look for is actually acoustics. On top of that, how far does sound travel? If you were to do a good whistle, where does that whistle go? Does it go way out to the next canyon? Does it bounce back? I mean, some of our calls that we've done in the past will go out like 5 miles and dogleg left and go out another mile or two. It's the thing to look for. But acoustics, I think, is important because that also lends credence to hearing things, recording. You can pick up recordings from great distances, which then helps you narrow down even more for a research area.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And go ahead.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, you're talking about these upper, lower, and middle areas when it comes to these research areas as to what you key in on, and then we're talking about altitude and all that. You know, how important is that? I mean, you know, if you're looking for an area to research, an area to record, how important is the where you place yourself in between these upper and lower and middle range areas, whether it's on a mountain or in a meadow?
Well, it's really important. By doing this, you're doing a couple things that you could be mimicking animals, for lack of a better term, like deer or elk. They're heat sensitive anyway, right? So, you know, they don't like being in the heat during the summer. Well, neither do we. So that food resource is sitting there. And then when you're in these areas and say you're just checking it out, you can camp there a couple of days or camp in an area for a couple of days and start walking around. This area, the area that we're researching now, I did just that and started walking around and started finding impressions all over the place. The first one we found was 19 inches long. I was like, huh, this is interesting. And then the following weekend, we started picking up audio. You know, so does it happen all the time? No, but these seem to be, if I was a cook in the kitchen, these are important ingredients to put in your saucepan for that perfect mix for your perfect Sasquatch soup.
Exactly. Yeah. And you mentioned bear. You know, it seems that when when you're out hiking or hunting, you know, you got the bear around and the deer and elk, but if you're just out there looking for animals in general, they seem to be in the same elevation, the same spot, I guess this is kind of obvious for a lot of people, but given the temperature and the altitude and everything else, I would imagine Sasquatch kind of follows along those lines because you know, these ungulates like deer and elk and whatnot, and you got your herbivores and everything else, they're found at the same elevations throughout the year. They're not always going to be found at the same elevation. I think a lot of people, especially researchers, hang around in the same elevation or go back to the same elevation year-round and don't get the same results. Well, I mean, they're not really following the pyramid of life, so to speak.
Right. Excuse me. You're right. One of the key ones that I think one of the key indicators besides deer and elk, pay attention to the bear, because they're eating everything, right? It's like this. If a bear can eat A, B, and C, well, Sasquatch would probably take A, B, and C as well. I think there's a correlation. And another important ingredient, believe it or not, are coyotes. I think they play a role in here, or they hang out. My hypothesis anyway, at least it's three areas that I know of that I've researched, that I've made contact, if you will, or recorded in, and have had activity in, is that there's a significant coyote population around, or they seem to hang around. It's odd enough, as soon as they go off, it gets quiet, and then you start getting action, or vice versa. Sometimes the Sasquatch goes off and there goes the coyotes. Or sometimes you can even see in your mind's eye that there, I think there's a relationship, or I feel like there might be a relationship with them. It's hard to explain.
Like a symbiotic relationship. Yeah, I really do feel that as well, Larry. I really do believe that with animals in general, especially in the wild, that there is a symbiotic relationship, a bit of I'll help you if you help me, maybe not on that level per se, but I think a lot of animals, I mean, this is, it's not even a thought process. This does happen where they kind of live off each other, and I do believe coyotes possibly play a huge part in the Sasquatch phenomena, as do, like, say, crows or ravens and maybe other animals. But, yeah, I think you're on to something there.
Yeah. I just got this feeling that because of the, you know, just the activities of, in three areas that I've been to that I've researched enough, on a consistent basis, one of the main ingredients of an area is that coyotes seem to hang, and it's without fail. I mean, the Tillamook Forest, though, for instance, there's not a night that has not gone by where I've not heard coyotes come up. But, you know, we got the eastbound coyotes and the westbound coyotes. But there's two packs. They're always hanging out. And in between all that, we get action. So there's something to it. I can't explain it, but there's something to this. I don't know why.
I agree with you. I'm not sure as to the connection there exactly. But the coyotes have played a major role, and we're not misidentifying coyote calls, as you will can explain. But there does seem to be, not just with our research, but with other researchers' findings, and with the general public, some sort of symbiotic relationship with a lot of animals out there. But specifically, I have to say, coyotes seem to play a part in this, and what that means exactly, I'm not sure yet. But I think we're really trying to key in on what they may be.
Yeah, right. Who knows? I mean, I don't believe Sasquatch has trained coyotes to find their food, but
right.
It could very well be similarly like the lions of the Serengeti when they do a kill, and you know, the hyenas come and clean up. It might be the same type of thing, you know, or
yes,
whatever. That's kind of my gut feeling. You know.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, I totally agree with that. You know, it makes sense, you know. I mean, I know hunters that, you know, they'll during, you know, the months of November, you know, when they're out hunting, you know, they'll actually gut their quarry out in the field, and they come back the next day, and everything's gone. Well, I think, you know, who knows? If Sasquatch actually does hunt or prey upon deer or elk or anything else, that the coyotes are not stupid. They're going to pick up on that and go, okay, well, here's an easy meal. We'll wait for the leftovers. We're going to follow these guys around. I think that's a very simple thing to think about. You don't have to really think outside the box there. It's really that simple. But it makes sense,
right,
because they do that with humans. I mean, look, coyotes, you know, I mean, there's been in the news lately, coyotes, you know, extreme amount of coyotes, you know, foraging around neighborhoods, you know, well, because humans leave trash and leave smelly stuff, you know, and as we encroach upon their territory, they are going to, they're going to take, you know, they're scavengers. Really, they're scavengers. They can be pack hunters, but you get a lot of lone coyotes and whatnot that scavenge, and they will, you know, take the easiest meal. Well, if they're following an apex predator around, you know, talk about easy meal if they're taking down huge quarry like elk or deer or anything else.
Right.
Leftovers.
Right.
So it makes perfect sense, right? I mean.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it does. So
makes
those are some of the things that we look for. And again, I think the most important part is altitude, and basically from a summit of, like, say, a mountain peak, and then if you could take a look at a topographical map and try to find a step or bench that comes out, and then another drop. So you want to be in the middle section for quite a few reasons. Again, that's going to create a microclimate where the climate's more stable, it doesn't get too hot, and it doesn't get too cold, so there's less snowfall as well during the winter. And then, of course, if you get lucky enough where you find that year-round body of water, i.e., a creek that runs year-round, or a pond system, beaver ponds, whatever, that's year-round. That's just something that we look for. I would like to. I should probably look for beaver ponds because cattails is another real good food resource too.
Right.
Forgot about that until just now. I just have
plenty.
Another area in mind. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But those are really important. And it lends to some acoustics as well when you're in that sweet spot that I'm trying to describe, because the sound carries so much better. If I was to go out to tomorrow and try to find a spot, first I would consult a topographical map first. And then I would try to meet up those criteria, which I was talking about, and then go there. And then find the spot, maybe do a daytime hike around the area and see what I could find. And if there's Cedar Creeks, and get a feel for the area. And I'd probably set up some, later that night, I'd probably set up some audio. It's the quickest way to find out and things around. It doesn't mean, like, if you don't pick anything up the first day or two, it doesn't mean they're not there or not in the area. You have to get to know your area, just like we did with our areas, up at Mount Hood and the Tillamook Forest, because they're not always vocal every single night, or, you don't hear anything. I like to just sit quiet and listen. Just like in the last show prior, is that decompression thing. But you can hear a lot of things at night just by listening, real quiet. Don't make any calls or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And let the environment, if you will, tell you what's going on.
Well, Larry, that's a great point. Here's the thing for me personally is that I don't think people that do research or claim to have encounters, I don't think Sasquatch is around in that particular area all the time. That would be silly, in my opinion, to assume that Sasquatch is going to hang around the same spot all the time, just like I would assume that it'd be silly to think that a bear, a coyote, or any other animal is going to hang around one area the whole time. They have to move. They have to forage. They have to stay out of eyesight. They have to mate. It's silly to think that an animal, even such as Sasquatch, would be around one area all the time. But I do believe that in some areas specifically that we research, they pass through periodically. There's reasons they pass through, I believe, given the clear cuts and the amount of natural resources available. And I think sometimes they're just passing from point A to point B. And with some of the possible, the very suspect stuff that we've had happen in some areas that we research, I think that they're kind of keying in on the human element, going, oh, this is interesting, let's check this out. But with the question posed to you, Larry, is, really, what is the one thing, are you looking, when you go out to an area and you're going to research it, and I know you key in on, like I do, a few specific areas, but what is, like, the one thing you're looking for? Is it elevation? Is it natural resources? What is the one thing you're looking for in an area, besides maybe perhaps all the reported encounters in this area? Because I know, like I said, the areas that we research do have a lot of encounters, do have a lot of history. But what's the one thing when you're going to an area? What locks eyes with you when you're going out there?
Well, given that I've been out in the woods so much, I don't even give it much thought, but I could.
Right.
I could say, I'll just have to say it this way. Elevation plays a key role, without a doubt, especially here in the Pacific Northwest. Elevation is a key role, in my opinion. Almost without fail, I could take a look at a topographical map and after some study go, that's a spot I want to go check out. Again, I'm looking for that criteria, that sweet spot between a summit or the highest part of an area, a middle sweet spot that's kind of like, that has, for lack of a better term, a a bench or, mm-hmm. you know, that would go out. And then it steps, then the altitude steps down even further. I look for that middle part. There's lots of reasons why. Again, one of the reasons in there is because it creates this little microclimate that it's just a sweet spot for climate.
Mm-hmm.
Again, not too hot, not too cold. It's sustainable. It's a refuge of sorts. Again, based on everything that I've seen, where like during the pinch period during the winter when there's not much food resources, that the ungulates come in and hang out there. If I was an apex predator, I'd be like hanging out with the ungulates, but they're coming into this warmer area. Again,
you're a hunter, Larry. You're a hunter, Larry.
Yeah, there
so
you
go. Does this play a part?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
The other cool thing, what I like doing, even when I'm archery hunting, is I actually look for some of these type of areas off the beaten path, and I sit on these areas. And 90% of the time, I'll end up with my game crossing in front of me because of the areas that I pick. Migratory situations with elk, for instance, when they go to their calving areas, when they calve, is another thing I take into account. Three of the research areas that we go to, Shane, are calving areas.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you knew that or not, but they are.
Yeah.
Also, deer foal in these, they drop their fawns in these areas too. I've seen plenty of fawns in these areas. Matter of fact, 3 weeks ago, some guy poached a poor little fawn right in our area over here. I was not very happy about it, but I wish I would have caught the guy, but anyway, that's another story. But the thing is that that's another thing. It's very easy prey, you know, and so, again, a bear can get one of these guys or even top apex predator like a Sasquatch. We have no problem picking these things up.
Right, right, right.
Altitude plays a key role, I believe.
Yeah. And that's one of the key things that I specifically key in on is the altitude. But, you know, we're talking about acoustics as well. I mean, these areas mm-hmm. that I think your really solid researcher will key on is an area with acoustical value that has an area that is as researchers can record some really amazing acoustics, some vocals. One of the things I also see, though, is in some of these areas I think people are really keyed in on that are doing the subject justice is that they misread a lot of these acoustics because of the distance, the valleys, the elevation. I've seen this time and time again. I know that this is your kind of repertoire this is your thing, Larry, that you can key in on. A lot of people misread some of what they're recording or hearing. Yeah. I mean, a lot of, you know, we're just talking, I mean, I'll just say, talk about hunters and individuals out there go, hey, I heard this crazy call. I just saw something online today where there was a big stir about, and they posted this recording. And I'm like, instantly I knew it was coyote. And I could tell that it was a distance away. I could tell it was a valley. I mean, isn't that kind of important to kind of know, not just know the area, but also know how sounds travel and know what's making these sounds?
I think it's really important. Matter of fact, I think I would suggest that everybody who researches at least gets to know five nighttime animals' calls. Let's say, for instance, I've heard bear at night. I've heard bobcat at night. I've heard fox at night. Coyotes, barred owls, and what else? And some birds also call at night. So those are things you really got to get to know before you even start, you know, going, well, that's different. And I've actually recorded all these things, and I got them in my little library, so I could actually knock that against there. Foxes are crazy with their vocals and stuff, so that's something that everybody should know is fox calls. Still there? Hello?
Yeah, absolutely, Larry. Sorry. I was kind of listening to you there and trying to remember half the recordings I have of fox calls, because I have a few fox calls. I have a lot of coyote calls. A lot of people misinterpret fox calls and coyote calls, but they also misinterpret bird calls. I mean, there are certain birds out there, like your ravens and crows, that can make an amazing amount of sounds. And then, of course, you know, there's a lot of sounds that people are just not familiar with. You know, bears, cougars, cougars can scream like a dying woman, and a lot of people do not.
And they can make bird type sounds too, which is really
like
cool.
Like a chirp, yeah, like a chirp.
Yep.
And so
that's when they call
them really. And that's why I really believe it's important to know the area you're researching. And if you're not a researcher, at least, you know, be prepared that what you're recording or hearing could be a known animal, because everything posted online nowadays is, whoa, I was scared out of my wits. I heard this and that, and I listened to it. I'm like, well, that's probably a cougar, or that's, no doubt a coyote or some sort of bird or a bear moan. You know, I was out with I talked about this on the last show. I was out with Cindy Cadell near the nesting area that we're working on. And,
I think we recorded all of those out there.
Yeah, I heard a clear bear moan. We were pretty close to a bear, and it was no doubt a bear, but I never saw it. But I recognized the sound because I've been around bear, and I've listened to enough bear that moan, even though it was made the hair stand on my arm, I knew it was a bear. So it's very important to know these things in these areas. Elevation plays a huge part in how things are recorded and how things sound. And then, of course, the surrounding environment, whether they're in a valley or a meadow, sound echo, sound travels different. If you look at the barometric pressure, I mean, it's all different. And you got to recognize this, because sound will travel. You know, I mean, some of the areas that we go to, you know, the sound travels far, and some of the areas we go to, the sound doesn't travel that far. And so you got to recognize that and recognize the animals out there, the known animals, and try to differentiate between them. Now, there's certain sounds, though, that we listen to and we record that intrigue us. But one of the things that I know Larry, you do, and David Ellis does, and myself and many other individuals out there, maybe even listen to the show, do is they don't just listen to the sounds, they look at them visually. You know, if something intrigues us, we'll look at it visually on like a sonic, you know, a visualizer, and trying to separate that from known animals. And we look for the hertz and the sound range. And that really does paint a different picture, because sometimes a sound to us in just listening by ear will be amazing. And then we get it on a sonic visualizer and look at it and go, oh, okay, well, it's not that amazing. It's the probability of it is probably a coyote or this or that. And that's a key thing too. So just throwing that in there. But one of the other key things, you know, we look for in these areas is the natural resources. Like you mentioned, water. Why is something going to be in this area? You know, a lot of people claim that Sasquatch is in there year-round. And I'm not opposed to that if you have basically the perfect storm. You have the temperature, the natural fauna, the animals, and the natural resources. I'm not opposed to that, but I think animals in general, well, once an area is kind of depleted of natural resources or the temperature changes, will travel either, you know, upwards or downwards. You know, here in the Pacific Northwest, you know, they're going to travel down.
Right. Well, that's kind of a double-edged sword here. Two things is that we spoke about microclimates, for one thing, you know, that sweet spot that I spoke about. Elk, on the other hand, if they don't know about these little microclimates, will actually travel up higher in higher ranges because it's cooler in summer in those areas. Something to think about. But again, in their March, they calve in these microclimate areas, or you know, on their migratory routes. Now, the Pacific Northwest, the Roosevelt elk, for instance, they only travel, get this, they die within 11 miles of where they were born. They do, not 11 miles, 1 mile within where they were born. They have an 11-day cycle, which is about 11 miles, and that's all they travel year round.
Sounds like, yeah, sounds very similar to salmon. And this is why I wanted to get to and kind of led into that is with the lower elevations, given this time of year, you don't only have the temperate temperatures, but this time of year, towards the winter and the fall, you get the clams, you got the salmon spawning out, and then you have, you know, these ungulates traveling downwards in general towards, you know, more temperate weather and greener pastures. So you have almost a perfect storm. And then guess what? We're seeing this time of year, and I've seen this personally, viewing reports from all areas, the sightings start to peak up in the lower elevations, whether it's the beaches or and whatnot. You know, I mean, you're starting to see this spike, and it's a little spike. I'm not saying it's an extreme spike, but there's a spike here in sightings in some of these lower elevations where you're getting the spawned out salmon dying. They're plentiful, and the you know, the foliage and the clams and everything else. I mean, this is when you start seeing a spike in Sasquatch sightings in these lower elevations. I mean, is that kind of something that you fall in line with in your belief?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I agree 100%. Now, here's another one: the high mountain lakes that have kokanee spawn just like a salmon, have the same, almost the same identical spawning season, and there's another food source, a year-round lake, right? Feeder streams that feed into it. Mm-hmm. Kokanee are landlocked salmon. They swim up the streams to spawn, and you have the same scenario playing out up in the mountains as well, where I've heard reports of Sasquatch being too. We both know somebody who actually saw one at one of these lakes that had kokanee.
Another
interesting point that you brought up, but that's something that simple math would say, well, there's a food resource. And what Steve was talking about, that Sasquatch was looking in the boats for fish.
Yeah. No, great point. Great point. Another thing is, this is time of year where we get the chanterelles. There's a lot of mushrooms this time of year. There's different types of
you got morels, you got chanterelles, you got all sorts of different ones. Cauliflower mushroom, all sorts of resources right
now. So that really plays a part in this pyramid of life, whether it's a known animal or not. And we're talking about Sasquatch specifically, but, you know, with Sasquatch, I would assume if they're this, you know, apex predator, or at least a large, you know, omnivorous thing, they're going to have to follow the same guidelines as any other known animal out there, whether it's bear or elk or deer or anything else like that. I mean, it just makes a lot of sense, does it not?
They got to go to the grocery store, too.
Exactly.
Yeah, they got to get their groceries.
Yeah, they got to get their groceries, and they have to they have to live in these areas, and they're not going to find resources this time of year up high. It's going to be lower elevation. That's where we're starting to see, you know, a perfect example is if you guys have listened to the show, we often preach talk about Squatch Metrics. You know, the Squatch Metrics, you can find them on Facebook. Squatch Metrics is a great resource for Sasquatch and numbers and graphs and looking at the numbers when it comes to supposed Sasquatch behavior or sightings. Fantastic resource. I can't say enough about Squatch Metrics. If you get a chance, jump on Facebook and look it up. Give it a like, you know, Squatch Metrics a like. And then look at what's, you know, scroll down the page of Squatch Metrics. The numbers are phenomenal. And numbers don't lie. They're there. And maybe it will, if you're a researcher or enthusiast or someone just interested in the subject period, you'll see these numbers. And maybe they'll click with you. So I definitely recommend checking out Squatch Metrics. Looks like my caller here. Hold on a second. But these numbers really... something to look at. And Squatch Metrics does a great job. So please look out Squatch Metrics on Facebook, though he's on Twitter. I don't think he's active on Twitter, but on Facebook, hugely active. And these numbers will blow you away. Are you with me, Larry?
No.
Good.
You got me?
Yeah, I got you there. Sorry,
Hello.
I think I dropped you.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyways, Larry, so we're talking about areas of interest, areas that we research. One of the things I wanted to get into a little bit was, you know, I want to get into gifting and baiting because, you know, we're getting out of hunting season now. We're in, you know, late hunting season for a lot of people. But gifting is a funny thing, and by gifting, I mean leaving gifts out for Sasquatch, as some researchers do. I don't personally subscribe to this. I don't personally do it. But there are individuals that will leave out supposed gifts, whether it's a teddy bear or a dog toy or candy or food. It's something that I take a little bit of issue with, not just because in a lot of ways you can get in trouble for this, you know, I mean, especially during hunting season, you know, here in Washington and Oregon, you can't bait black bears, but how is a game warden or a park ranger supposed to know the difference, with some of the stuff left out there? I mean, what are your thoughts on gifting and baiting in general? I mean, because here's one of my other issues I'll lead you off with, is that most of the time, people will leave something out in the woods or, you know, whether it's food or a toy or something of that nature, and they'll come back going, well, it was moved, it was this or that, but they have nothing else to back up their statement or their what they subscribe was a Sasquatch. I mean, there's just nothing to back it up. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that is a hard one. With regards to baiting, as you already said, it's illegal here in the state of Oregon and Washington. That's for baiting for bear or cougar, for that matter. You can't do either. It could be construed by a game warden. Say, for instance, somebody leaves some food out that they're baiting, and someone could get in some trouble if ever get caught. I mean, they look for this stuff, and they'll sit on it, you know, and then you got some explaining to do. Whether they believe you or not, it's going to be a whole entire different story. They usually don't believe anything, and you'll get a ticket. Food for thought.
Right.
They're real sticklers with that here, at least in Oregon. I don't know how much of a stickler they are in Washington, but in Oregon, they live and breathe and eat to try to find somebody doing that stuff.
Right.
That's just the way they are.
Right.
Yeah. And then you've got cross-jurisdictional areas, too, where you got state land, you got BLM land, which is federal, and then you've got national, like national forests and stuff. Whole different thing, whole different sets of rules. You have your state laws, and then you fall into federal laws. I mean, it could be a nightmare. Personally, wouldn't do it. Not worth the risk. But, you know, to each their own. As for the other thing with the leaving of the toys and things like that, well, that could be construed as, you know, again.
Littering.
You know, littering, you know.
Yeah.
And the thing is well, they opened a page to 296, or that the doll was moved to the next stump. Well, we got this critter called a raccoon. They usually pick up things and move things all over the place. We got squirrels that kick, they're like, oh, there went the book. It flipped. Well, they, you know, squirrels are all over the place. Ravens, they fly, oh, what's that? They fly down, maybe they pick it up and drop it. Who's to say? Where's the proof? If I were to leave a marble out there, maybe I might have a game cam on it and see what moved the marble. I don't know. But the thing is, if you don't have anything to back it up and it's all conjecture, well, then it goes into the conjecture box. You can't say with definitive proof that it was Sasquatch that played with the doll, opened the book to chapter 2, or set some sticks on a side and put a rock on the other side that type of thing, or, you know, move your sticks or whatever, have a way, because there's too many variables out there to not consider. With us, it's Bigfoot last, unless we have some definitive proof. Otherwise, it's like, that's interesting. By the way, that was
right.
Cool. It got moved over there. But we don't even assume Sasquatch unless we laid eyes on it ourselves, or, you know, actually got video or whatever. Otherwise, it just goes in that interesting file, or like, well, you know, what is it? What's doing that? And above all things, is that we have to search for, you know, repeatability. You know, if it happens again at the same place, or, you know, and if it keeps on happening, it keeps on being put in the same place. Well, that might pique my interest a little bit, you know, as a science guy. And, of course, I would definitely have some cameras around in the area so I could see what's going in and out of the area. Maybe put one down a camera 50 feet away from there, or in a circle or something like that. Set up a camera trap. See what's going in and out of there so that you actually know. Otherwise, I just don't subscribe to that. It's like we're already, like, say, if we're camping in an area, technically we're baiting. We got food in our area, so they can come by and steal our eggs if they want, which has happened. I don't know very many things that go open up a cooler and egg carton and take four eggs out of it, you know.
Right.
And leave
the cooler
open.
There's certain scenarios.
Bears got pretty nimble hands, so who knows, you know. That's the other thing, too.
Certain scenarios that really stand out, especially with our research, but the majority of it, if you don't see what did it, and, I mean, there's ton. I mean, it's hard for me to fathom that in a lot of scenarios, Sasquatch doing this sort of stuff without any subsequent, you know, documentation, any, you know, whether someone actually saw Sasquatch do this or they have it on camera, or even have something of interest on audio. I mean,
exactly.
Do things like this.
Exactly, I was just going to bring that up.
Yeah, the audio, I mean, audio can play a huge part. You know, it won't prove anything, but it can maybe paint a better picture of what took place. And we do that time and time again, but I have a real issue with, and you see this on YouTube and a lot of these different avenues where people will say they're habituating something, and it's just basically stick formations or things being moved, and it's like you're really not habituating, especially in some, you know, the Pacific Northwest. Shoot, we have a load of animals up here. You know, I've run into
right.
bear quite a few times. I got, you know, my game cameras. I have raccoon galore. I have squirrels. I have ravens and crows. Deer and elk do odd things at times. You have weasels. There's a plenitude of animals that will do things of this nature, move stuff and whatnot. I really do believe you have to think Sasquatch last, because if you're getting this much supposed Bigfoot behavior, it should be documented, and you should have some sort of solid evidence of a Sasquatch doing what you're saying that they are doing, and I just don't see it. And that falls in line with, for me, that Sasquatch is a rare thing. And, you know, these people that say they're habituating, I do take an issue with, because I don't see enough evidence to say that they're habituating anything other than possibly a bear, a raccoon, a pack rat, a rat, you know, you name it. There's a lot more animals that are that there's more of than I believe Sasquatch to be.
Exactly. You know, the thing is especially in the areas that we were talking about with all the prime ingredients, if you will, well, then is all the animals within that area. One of the things you got to do is actually get to know the animals in the area, because, they do play a major role in some of your research with regards to either audio or, you know, for instance, I forget what kind of bird this is, a very bold gray bird. It looks sort of like a blue jay, but they're not. But they're very bold. They come into camp, and they move things around all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Pick up stuff, fly off with it. I wouldn't put it past them to do other things too. During nesting season, anything shiny, any bird would pick up that any shiny thing that's left out there and use it for their nest. Same with pack rats; they do the same thing. Well, this thing's gone. Well, how do you know it's not a pack rat or a bird? They just don't. So you can't assume this stuff.
Right.
Again,
you
have to take it to the next level, and that is just actually set up actual camera traps so you could actually trap with film or digital film, that is, what's actually doing the activity in the area. And a lot of people I've talked to over the years is that, oh, there was this big truck. Really? You got a picture of it? Well, and all I see is, they showed me a track. It's just a couple of disturbed sticks, and that's a track.
Yeah.
I'm going, no, I don't see anything here. Where's your tape measure? You know, there's some criteria, that you got to have while you're out in the field. Never go out in the field without a tape measure. You know, you get a small one that's, a 15-foot tape measure. It's like maybe an inch around that you have in your pocket with you all the time. You need something, a point of reference when you're taking pictures, especially of impressions. If you don't happen to have your hydrocal with you, at least document it with that. They're really cheap, but you do need to have the basic tools when you're out researching.
A reference. Yeah, you have to have a reference. But I'm not trying to make the show or Monstrex a negative Nancy. What I'm trying to portray here is that if you're serious about this research or serious about the subject, whether you're actually out in the field trying to obtain something or you're looking at evidence online, you know, you got to look at the devil's in the details always. And so you got to document, and also just an enthusiast, just interested in the subject, you got to really look at the details. I mean, a lot of people like shock and awe. I get that. You know, you love to jump on YouTube and see a picture of a Sasquatch running across the wooded line or whatnot. But, you know, you can't take it at face value. Most of that stuff is, quite honestly, hoaxed. And so if you're out in the field, I mean, in researching or just looking at the subject from, you know, behind a computer screen, really got to do your homework on it if you're serious about the subject. If you just want shock and awe, well, jump on Netflix and watch some Bigfoot flick. You know, like I said, I'm not trying to be a negative Nancy here because I know Sasquatch to exist, as does Larry. I mean, they exist. They're out there. But what they are, we don't know. But they're not as common as people claim they're to be. And that's the thing. Is in this research, it's really about looking at the details, you know, looking at known animals, where they're going to be at any given time of year, the elevation, the altitude, the natural resources. And then, you look at the history reports too, because don't get me wrong, the Oregon coast has a plethora dating back to the Native Americans of reports, as does Mount Hood, as does the Olympics, areas that we research. They have a plethora of reports that I take. I don't just look at face value. I do my research on them and take that into account. But I don't subscribe to everything put out there, especially when it comes to the stuff nowadays, because it's just thrown at you. It's thrown at you like candy, and then a lot of people hook, line, and sinker will bite on that. And I, you know, it really does a disservice to the Sasquatch phenomena in general, because then science looks at it and goes, well, that's a hoax. I mean, I just saw a few things today that floored me on social media that are basically a regurgitation of hoaxes and jokes, and people are like, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? I'm like, are you serious right now? Have you not? I mean, don't at least look at the person posting in the history of it or whatever, and then post it. But no, they just post it because right off the bat they see a picture. This is interesting. Well, you won't see that from a lot of your serious researchers and enthusiasts and whatnot. You won't see that because science wouldn't do that, and I won't do that, and I'm not a scientist. but I won't do that.
Right.
I mean, Larry, when's the last time you just threw something online that you thought was of interest? When's the last time?
Never.
Exactly. Yeah, and you have a lot of interesting stuff.
Yeah, I've never thought none of my stuff's been for or our stuff has been for public consumption. It goes into the strange file because I didn't see Sasquatch do it. One other point with regards to our potential research area.
Yeah.
There's a little research and see, for instance, what the old name was of the area with regards to Indian names. Now, some of the old names, or some of the names like Devil's This or Skookum That, key in on that stuff. There's some history involved. There's other names that's eluding me right now, but it's almost without fail. There's history about that, especially some of the old Indian names or some of the ones like up at Ape Canyon, there was a devil something. I can't remember what that was. But there's a reason for all this stuff. It's historical. Those are things you might want to key in on. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a great point. But that's going above and beyond your average research is not just taking, don't research an area or look as an area as a Sasquatch area unless you've done your research on the area.
Right.
Is there some sort of supportive thing to that area? Is it just a lone sighting, which could happen, but is there a history there? Is something going on bigger than just one report or one sighting? You know, and I've done this time again, whereas I've had a report come to me or a sighting, and I'm like, okay, well, that sounds interesting, and I've done my research on the area and realized, wow, there's been multiple sightings in this area or multiple whatever in this area, and then it piques my interest. And then I
right.
do believe there may be something going on there, and then that leads me to actually getting really heavily involved in that area as the Oregon coast, as Mount Hood, as the Olympics, where there's been not just one sighting or one historical report, but multitudes of reports. And then I can look back and go, okay, well, the Native Americans in this area were reporting stuff. So there's a history. Yeah, that's key. I think that's a huge key to this thing. And I really do believe that, not just looking at the historical reports, but looking at the time of year and, what the other animals are doing in this area, what that means.
Yeah, exactly. I think a little homework's real important. I mean, you get the once in a while somebody driving by the seat of their pants, flying by the seat of their pants, driving down a logging road, and they happen to see one. But
right.
to have consistency, and if you actually have a research area, well, you have to do all that stuff. Everything
right.
listed
right.
that we spoke about. A little research. Now, does that mean that altitude may or may not play a role in every part of the country? I don't know. It seems to prove out between Oregon and Washington and Northern California with regards to the altitude, the acoustics, the ungulates, the food, the year-round bodies of water. It does play a role. There's so
yeah.
much similarities between the Tillamook Forest, which we both research, and the Olympic area where we research that it's just uncanny.
I mean,
almost identical feel, almost identical with regards to the altitude, the altitude drops between the peaks and where the awesome acoustics are in that sweet spot, which I spoke about. They're almost identical acoustics. Would you agree?
Oh, I would agree, and I would say that it's exciting because now you're starting to see a lot of similarity in these different areas, these different climates, you know, given the times of year, but you're starting to see similarity in all of this stuff, and I think that's you know, it's collaboration, but also research in these different areas will add to the numbers, you know, that we're seeing. And I'm seeing them, you know, with reports from both researchers and just people out hunting, hiking, fishing, doing whatever they're doing. You're seeing these similarities in these different areas.
Exactly.
And that's key. I mean, that's exciting to me, is that we're seeing different times of year and different sightings and whatnot, but there's a little bit of a formality, a little bit of a consistency there.
Yeah, the other cool thing is that between the Olympic Project and Tillamook Forest, we are now seeing similar audio.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean is similar calls, chest beats that we've recorded in the Tillamook Forest, that we've recorded up in the Olympics. That's repeatability. And the distance between the 300 miles. This is rather exciting when you're getting similar calls, if you will, or, you know, similar audio signatures, not the individual signatures, but, you know, similar signatures and similar,
right.
You know, like the chest beats. About, well, that's just so exciting. There's so much this puzzle together like never before.
Right. Yeah, and that's the thing, though, is it's not just here in the Pacific Northwest. We're seeing stuff in different parts of the nation, where I expect, you know, after reviewing a lot of reports in these areas, is similar behavior, and we're seeing that. And so we're starting to paint a picture here that I don't think has been painted before in this caliber.
No.
And it's exciting. You know, I mean, we'll see what happens. You know, I mean, we're talking, you know, about a subject that's looked at as kind of hokey and whatnot, but we're starting to see patterns and stuff. We'll see where this leads to with this collaboration and these findings and this documentation. We'll see what it leads to. I'm enthusiastic about the future of the Sasquatch phenomenon and the where it's leading, Larry. But Larry, we're at the end of the show, man. I really appreciate you joining me. Any final words here?
No, I think we covered it. We'll come up with another fireside chat, I'm sure.
yeah, we always do. I'm always really enthused to talk to you. I always have a great conversation with Larry, and you're, like I said before in the show, you're somebody I love to go out to the woods with and just and do what we love to do, and that is get out there and do you know, some Bigfooting and as we call it, you know, and research. And, you know, we don't always come away with anything, but sometimes we get some nuggets. And that's what research is all about, is, you know, being enthused about the subject and being skeptic, you know, having your little skeptics on and whatnot. But we do get those golden nuggets at times, and that makes it all worthwhile. And then, again, spending time out in the woods together.
Yeah, that's right. I really enjoy it, too.
Yeah. Well, Larry, thanks again for joining me here on Monster X Radio, man. I really appreciate it, and we'll talk to you soon and have me back on the show.
All right, man. Good talking to you.
All right. Take care.
Night.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Monster X Radio, as I did. You know, this Sasquatch phenomenon is really intriguing, and I really like to pull in those individuals from time to time that I think that are that not only take this subject seriously, but have their skeptic goggles on and can differentiate the known stuff from the unknown. And Larry Turner is one of those, and there's many others out there. And I hope to seek those out, and those individuals out, and get them on the show, because I'm very passionate about this, you know. And you know, it's a fun topic to talk about. There's a lot going out there. And a lot going on. And so you all have a great evening. We'll talk to you soon. Try some Sasquatch coffee if you're a little bit tired there and want to listen to the rest of the show. Otherwise, you know, hey, we'll talk to you all next time out. Squatch on.
Monster X Radio.